This Adams Division podcast is taped in front of a live studio audience.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Here's Park, the draw, the shot. It trickles in. It's knocked away. Park with it. Scores! Brad Park wins the game. Brad Park, a rebound. And the Bruins win 3-2.
Pumping it up to LaFontaine. He gets tripped up, gets it to May, and over the line. He's May going in on goal. He shoots. He scores! Mayday! 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 Brad May wins it in overtime!
After minutes turn to hours and hours turn to days and days turn to months, the Adams Division podcast is back. I am co-host Steve Bennett along with my main man, Peter Winston. What's up, Peter? We're back.
Oh, it's been a long time. It's been about, what, 6 months now since, Survivor Series that we did?
Yeah, November. So
is that the...
So I was figuring this out. So this is the fifth one. We started this off with the recap of my top 100 wrestler list, which is like 2 years ago now, right? Like we're on the...
It was January of 2018, which I recorded on the other sofa in my basement that I'm looking at right now. And the thing that I remember most about that is I was freezing at the end of it because I forgot to wear a sweatshirt because my basement's very cold.
So then we moved on to WrestleMania, and I think we did number 1 to 14 on WrestleMania. We ranked those.
Right.
And then we moved on to SummerSlam, and I believe we did 88 to 99, or did we stop at 98?
Oh, we stopped at 98,
okay,
yeah.
So 88 to 98. And then we did Survivor Series, about the same range there, 87 to Deadly Game. I think we did Deadly Game because I was there. And yep. Then we were prepping to do a Royal Rumble episode. And then you switched jobs, and... we kind of were putting it off, and we were about to get to it probably, and then I died. And that delayed...
Well, yes.
Yes, and that delayed us. And I don't know when we would get back. Like, I was thinking, like, if we can't wait till Royal Rumble again, because that's just too far away. The idea will die by then. And I figured, why not? Let's just do this. The Bruins are in the Cup. An Adams Division team is in the Cup. Let's celebrate it by ranking our top 10 sports teams of all time. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And we'll get to that in a minute. But before we do, we should mention, as you heard in the very beginning there, that this is now, the Adams Division podcast is now going to live on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. So thanks to Justin and Scott for inviting us over there. Peter, you were just on this week on the main show, the flagship, and I was on 513 and 518, and I'm on again on June 17th, whatever number that will be. So we've been on quite a bit, and now the Adams Division podcast will live there.
Well, I'm wondering, is this kind of like the Canadian lines where we have to have a fixed percentage of wrestling content in order to pass muster on the feed? Like one of the sports teams of all time is like Team Angle or something like that.
Every fourth song needs to be the Tragically Hip. Yes, every fourth song needs to be the Tragically Hip, or we lose our license. But thanks to, like I said, thanks to them for inviting us on. And we have a fun one, like I said, tonight. We're going to rank our sports teams. Generally speaking, this is just going to be about whatever we feel like it. Sometimes it'll be wrestling. Sometimes it won't. This time it's not. The archives of it live on your feed, correct? On the Greetings from Allentown feed, Peter?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, so you can find the other ones there. And also, I think you can find them on Pro Wrestling Only, too. I don't know if it's sin to mention that. But the archives are out there if you want to go back and listen, if you're new to it, because you're finding us on the Place to Be Nation feed. We should mention our work that we do outside of here as well, while our listeners are alert and with us. Who knows if they'll be there by the time we announce our top teams. We may have bored them to death by then. I'll quickly mention the Sportscasters is my main gig. You can find it at soundcloud.com/sports-casters. Or you can, of course, go to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. I was mentioning I noticed that Stitcher was a sponsor of like the NBA Finals the other night in the 3 minutes that I watched trying to win a burrito during the first quarter before realizing it was going to be way too difficult, and I shut it off. The point of bringing it up is Stitcher, they're nice. If you kind of bust their chops a little bit, they'll send a tweet out for you. I've done that a few times for me. But this week on the Sportscasters was Michael Lombardi, 3-time Super Bowl champion, twice with those New England Patriots. Who knows, maybe one of his Patriot teams will be in Peter's top 10. I can tell you now, neither of those Patriots teams made mine. Maybe his Brown, maybe his 49ers team did from the 80s. That'd be weird, but maybe. We'll see. And also, Will Leach was on the show. And Will's an old friend of the podcast, and we caught up and talked about all of his different jobs, although we did get stuck in the Trump vortex a little bit for a few minutes, which is never good. But
it happens.
Yeah, for more information, it's at sports_casters on that. What do you got?
Well, greetings from Allentown, which you can hear on my own feed and on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. It takes a look at one episode of wrestling television, generally from the 80s and 90s, although I am planning a show. It could be the next one. It could be the week after. It's still in the planning stages, where I'm going to actually look at something from the year 2000 for the first time, which I don't know how the audience is going to react to that, because I seem to get way more feedback the further back that I go. Like this 1980 show that I just did, way more feedback up front about that. But
I seen someone mention that like someone from the show is their principal or something like that on Facebook, or their substitute teacher or something like that. Dave Rollins, shout out to Dave. Big fan of your show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't get to see Facebook and Twitter as much at work because we have this weird Wi-Fi situation. Actually, I was going to say at my employer, but technically I'm not an employee, which is a whole other story, where you get a guest Wi-Fi, but you can't use Twitter, you can't use Facebook, but you can use WhatsApp. So I can communicate with people via WhatsApp. And text messages sometimes go through and sometimes they don't. Like when we were planning this, I would send something, and then if it wouldn't send, I'd have to walk out to the hallway or the stairwell and hit resend. It's a real pain in the ass. And yes, Dave Rollins. Rocky Jones was a substitute teacher in my school in the 8th grade and talked about his match with Hulk. And that is the great Mike Masters, who took on Hulk Hogan on that episode of All Star Wrestling. Rather bizarre one, yeah.
Dave Rollins, a big fan of Motley Crue, who has entered that real weird spot in my world where I'm afraid of them, because just before I died in March, I was watching The Dirt. So it was like The Dirt came out, I spent the night watching it, and by the time Ozzy Osbourne was sniffing ants off of the concrete, I was like, oh shit, I have to go to the hospital for the next 2 months. Well, not that I realized it'd be 2 months at the time, but yeah. So now I'm like oddly afraid of Motley Crue a little bit. You know, it's like a scar or something that's cutting deep. But yeah, I enjoy the older ones too for some reason. You know what ones I've really enjoyed in the past are like the just before Hulkamania. Like I think you did an 83 or two. Didn't you do an 83 where Iron Sheik was the champion still in between him beating?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that one. That might be my number one.
There's one weekly show after Sheik wins the title, but before Hogan shows up. And I covered that one, which has Sheik crying as Arnold Skolland tries to confront him. And I actually gave some advice to Skolland and how he should have helped Bob a little bit better. See, we're actually getting quite a bit of wrestling content in. So yeah. I think that now this actually does belong on the wrestling feed, because we're actually talking about it a little bit up front.
I watch a lot of old school wrestling with my daughter, and she loves the entrance themes. And we were watching the Pile Driver like home video, Coliseum home video, and the very first video on there is for the song Pile Driver. And Arnie Skoland is like a big part of that video because he plays the foreman on the video. And my daughter is just like so puzzled by it. I'm like, who's he? Is he the Hulk's boss? But
Daddy, why is he going into the bathroom with that magazine?
Right.
Like, well, sometimes when a man gets aroused looking at a woman in a bathing suit, he has to never mind.
Oh, he fell in the potty. He fell in the potty. That's what she thinks about that scene. And she loves the honky tonk man theme like you would not believe. Like that, she could listen to that. It's like her black right now.
So like, maybe there's room for a new honky tonk man, but one who's kind of like a Raffy who appeals to kids, or like a Johnny Karate from Parks and Rec. Maybe there's room for a character like that.
You know what I need your advice on is, like, okay, so she loves hockey, so we take her to a hockey game, right? She loves Disney, so we take her to Frozen on Ice. And she's bugging me. She wants me to take her to wrestling, and I'd love to take her to the matches, but the problem is she has no idea that, like, the Mega Powers exploding didn't happen yesterday. You know what I mean? Like, she watches all these matches with me, and to her, all these guys are still alive and vibrant. You know what I mean? Like, she wants to go to wrestling because she wants to sit by the ring because she wants Bret Hart to give her his glasses.
Yeah, that's a thing where you might have to present this as, let me show you this. This is what I watched when I was a kid. I was a little bit maybe older than you are now, but that might be the way you'd want to set it up. Because I know that, like, when my nephews were here and I was trying to show them stuff, and they're like, yeah, this is great. Can we put on John Cena versus The Undertaker from, like, 2003? I'm like, what? That actually happened? And then they spent 30 minutes trying to find it on YouTube and failed, and then they had to leave. So I'm not sure what the point of that story was, but let's just say it was a slice of American life. Like, it can be difficult to try and, you know, get them to watch that older stuff and understand that, yeah, this is not current.
I would say if Paula came over to your house tomorrow, the match she would most want to show you is Boss Man versus Mountie from SummerSlam 91 because she loves the whole jail angle. She just, she loves that.
Well, she is right to feel that way.
Yeah.
Because I think that is great for kids of all ages, whether they be 0 or 104, basically anywhere in between.
Well, as Jeff Perlman once told me on the Sportscasters, much to the chagrin of my mother, nobody cares about your kids. So we have other business to attest to. We're going to take a break. And we're going to be right back. We're going to count down our list of our all-time favorite sports teams. And we also have lists provided from some listeners and actually a couple of former guests on the Sportscasters. So we'll throw them in now. And again, I'll read a couple of lists off. But right now we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back on the other side with numbers 10 through 6.
Broadway's dark tonight. A little bit weaker than you used to be. Broadway's dark.
All right, we are back. This is the Adams Division Podcast. Peter Winston and Steve Bennett here with you. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to count down our top 10 all-time favorite sports teams because it seems like what the Adams Division Podcast is, and I don't know if we planned this or it just happened, but it's a countdown show. And I don't know how that happened, but
yeah.
I don't think I ever said to Peter, like, hey, let's do a podcast where we just count shit down. But that's what happened. So today's countdown is our favorite sports teams of all time. And if I can explain that for a second, I don't mean like number one's the Saints, number two's the Bills, number three's the Pirates. I don't mean that. What we're doing is we're talking about specific teams. The 2001 Portland Trailblazers might be on a list, or the 1993 Miami Hurricanes. Who knows? We will find out, and I will get us going. It's 10 each. I also got some lists from listeners of both of our podcasts that we'll throw in now and again. I'll read off a list. But we will start this off with my number 10 team, a team that Peter has criticized in the past. We'll see if we get into it. But my number,
I walked it back a little bit later on.
My number 10 team is the 1993 New York Rangers, who ended 40 years of frustration. No more 1940.
You mean 93-94 Rangers. You just said 93.
Yeah, 93-94, like the cup.
I'm pretty sure you didn't mean that weird team that ended up missing the playoffs.
No.
John Van Beesbrook.
Right. If I missaid that spoke, I apologize. But yeah, the 93-94 New York Rangers winning the cup in one of the great playoffs of my lifetime. Their seven-game series against the Devils is one of the great seven-game series of all time. Two double overtime games, of course. Double overtime in Game 7 and Steph Amateau with that kind of strange wraparound goal that Brodeur, I'm sure, still has nightmares about. Really a really...
The three rings since then have eased pain a little bit.
Yeah, but you know how athletes are, right? Like, they'll always look back at the ones they didn't get, too. Like, my brother still says, like... Well, we can talk about that later. But yeah, like, athletes, they do focus on their losses sometimes more than their wins, but this is just a fun run. You know, like the Sabres lost to the Devils that year in the second round of the playoffs. And, once that happened, I kind of just kind of focused in on the Rangers and kind of enjoyed their run. And I was a huge Pavel Bure fan at the time. Well, I'm still a huge Pavel Bure fan. And I got to just kind of settle in and enjoy it and love that Stanley Cup. One thing about the Bure versus the Rangers angle is everyone always thinks of his penalty shot that got stopped in Game 4 by Richter, which is a huge play in the series, obviously. But in Game 3, he had one of the all-time craziest first periods a superstar's ever had in the Stanley Cup Finals. He scored an unbelievable breakaway goal in the first minute of the game. Pacific Coliseum's about to blow up. And then midway through the first period, he goes to kind of get under Jay Wells, of all people's stick. Comes up, cuts him, and gets thrown out of the game. Thrown out of a Stanley Cup final game. So, crazy.
Well, it's a shame that he wasn't Wayne Gretzky and that Kerry Frazier wasn't officiating, because then they would have allowed him to go, you know?
Well, it was kind of one of those...
Just like the year before in 93.
It was like one of those things where, like, flipping the puck out of the arena is now. You know, where
it was an automatic thing.
Right, yeah. If you cut a guy back then, it was automatic 5 minute. And man, what a trade-off for the Rangers. But a great team. God bless Mark Messier and his guarantee. Richter and Leach, two of the great American hockey players of all time. And if you go back to the Sportscaster's archives, I did about a 40-minute retrospective on this with John Dallapina from New York Daily News at the time, who was covering the Devils, and then once the Devils went out, covered the Cup for the Rangers, and we went through all this, and it's a really fun spot, and that's my number 10, the 93-94 New York Rangers.
Now, I do have a correction for you. The Sabres lost to the Devils in the first round that year, and I know that because my Bruins lost to the Devils in the second round. I went to Game 4 of that series. It was a double overtime loss. So I feel like my fandom is just littered with overtime losses, either at Boston Garden or TD Garden, just over a very long period of time. But that Rangers team, even though they had missed the playoffs the year before, they were kind of a sneaky, strong, like good non-playoff team that had a lot of pieces, and they just really went for it that year. They made a lot of acquisitions at the trade deadline. They had Mike Keenan as a coach, who's definitely like a short-term solution if there ever was one in the NHL.
Absolutely.
So with all that, they go into the playoffs, they absolutely run over the Islanders in the first round. I think they take out the Capitals in five games.
Yep.
And the Caps were coming off beating Pittsburgh, so that team wasn't, you know, any sort of joke. You get the great series against New Jersey. It's a top five NHL series of all time by any standard, because you got the rivalry there. It goes the full seven games, so it's going to draw your attention, and the double overtime in Game 7, the guarantee. And then the final versus Vancouver, also a great series. It's interesting to look back on that and how the Rangers had a 3-1 lead, and they lost Game 5 at home when they were basically ready to just run the damn parade, which good for them that they waited to win, because they ended up getting in that June 17th, 1994, 30-30 documentary, because it happened on that day. that game seven was, you know, I remember the game six in Vancouver was very exciting too, because I think there was a play in that game where a goal was scored and they didn't call it. And then another goal was scored down the other end at the same time. So they went to video review, and it was a rare situation, I think, where one team was going to be credited with a goal, and based on did the first one go yep. in? If it did, that counts, and the other one doesn't. And I think I remember it was going to be 3-2 or 4-1 based on it. And Vancouver, I think, got the goal, ended up being 4-1. But, you know, obviously I am not a Rangers fan at all. I did see that team live in March of 94 in a tie game against the Bruins, like 2-2. But, you know, lots of veteran presence all over that team. And I am one of the few people who likes Mike Keenan as a coach. So, you know, I walk back my criticism of against them being phonies, because the year before they didn't make the playoffs, and the year after they barely made it. But that was mitigating circumstance. It was a lockout. They were an old team. And
they had went all in the year before. I mean, they traded Tony Amonte, and I mean, they sacrificed their future to win that cup. And an interesting thing about them, when they went to game three of the Stanley Cup final, that was their first time on a plane in the entire playoff. And that might have been a big factor, especially when you get to, you know, the third period of a one goal game of a game seven of the final. You know, it's nice to, you think about Vancouver, they played Calgary, which, you know, that's their closest opponent the entire playoffs. Then they played Dallas. Nice, you know, nice little gap in space there. And then they play Toronto, which is a cross-country trip. And then, you know, of course, the Rangers. So,
if this was my podcast, I would play the More You Know theme, because I had never thought of that before, how the Rangers played three teams within driving distance of each other in the Eastern Conference playoffs. And when you get to the West, you know, obviously, yeah. Vancouver, that's the first time they actually have to get on a plane is in that series.
Yeah, because in the Washington series was basically a train trip back then in 94. So I don't know if they would fly there now, but they didn't fly there in 94. The first time that team got on a plane was Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Final. All right, Peter, why don't you – that's enough, I think, about the 94 Rangers. Why don't you give me your number 10?
Well, my number 10 is a team that you are very familiar with, and a lot of listenership would be, too, if they were baseball fans in this era. And this is going to come off as a very peculiar pick, because there are a lot of years you could choose for this team, but I chose the 1993 Atlanta Braves.
A team I love very much. They had an incredible pennant race with the Giants, but I'll let you lay everything out, and then I'll chime in after.
Well, I say unusual because you think of the first 2 years where they lost in the World Series to Minnesota and Toronto, especially that first year because it was so out of nowhere. And then you got the 95 team that actually won the World Series, who we might be hearing from later on as you're a Braves fan, or even any of the later era teams, because, I mean, they won, 14 consecutive division titles, not including that one weird strike year because it wasn't a full season.
All right, nobody.
But in 93, that pennant race goes into it. It was, and I think there was a book written on it by somebody, the last great pennant race, where the Braves won the division by one game over the San Francisco Giants, 104 wins. But the thing about that team is their games were airing on TBS regularly at that time. And for me and my dad watching baseball, the Red Sox are on locally, and they were an institution. You know, they are an institution and all that. But they were 80-82 team, and we were very interested in seeing guys like local boy Tom Glavine pitch. And one of the reasons why I would pick the 93 team is that's the year Greg Maddux comes to the Atlanta Braves, so you get the joy of being able to watch him pitch and just locate everything just absolutely precisely. But the pennant race is what you think of with the 93 Braves, because they started, like, if you'll pardon the expression, they started like shit that year. They started 11-13, but then they went 19-9 in July, 19-7 in August, 22-8 in September and October. The catalyst one of the catalysts being them acquiring Fred McGriff in the San Diego Padres fire sale. They won 51 out of 69 games after they got him.
And of course, you say fire sale. Remember his first night in Atlanta, there was a fire at the ballpark.
Yes, and, that's right.
So the Braves were on fire, the Padres were having a fire sale, and the stadium was on fire, and Fred McGriff was acquired. So lots of fires there.
So they come down to the last game of the season, and I believe Atlanta defeated Colorado at home, the expansion Rockies, and the Giants needed to win at Dodger Stadium, and they sent rookie King Salomon Torres to the mound, and he lost that game, I think, 10-1 or something like that. So the Braves get into the playoffs, and the reason why I think this team gets forgotten somewhat is they go to the NLCS and lose to a very charismatic Philadelphia Phillies team with Kroc and Schilling and Dykstra and Mitch Williams and all those various personalities. But out of all the Braves teams through the years, like that one was my favorite just because of how hot they got in that late summer stretch, and being able to watch all those games. That's kind of a key component to, I don't want to say I was emotionally invested in that team, but that Braves team would probably be the National League team that I rooted for at that time. I mean, I was in the eighth grade. I mean, it made perfect sense.
Look, baseball is better when you're watching a winner, right? I mean, it's hard. Baseball's a day in and day out thing, and that gets hard when you're watching a 58-104 team compared to a 104-58 team. But I always do feel a little bit bad for the Giants, right? I mean, 103 games and out. Nothing. 103 freaking wins and no playoffs, because this is before the wild card. So they were skunked out.
They obviously had a better record than the Phillies did in the NL East, although they were a very strong team. It's funny to think of, once again, the Atlanta Braves were in the National League West. Now, I know that there's a lot of geography bloopers in NFL, like your New Orleans Saints being in the NFC West along with the Atlanta Falcons, but the Atlanta Braves being in the NL West along with the Cincinnati Reds for so many years, while the Cardinals of St. Louis and the Chicago Cubs were in the NL East, was really something, I gotta say.
And if you read John Schuerholz's book, he talks a lot about how close Barry Bonds was almost a Brave instead of Maddox. And of course, Bonds goes to the Giants and Maddox goes to the Braves, and there's an interesting tie in there. The Braves actually, I think, almost traded for Bonds in 92. Schuerholz says it didn't happen, and then going into free agency, they knew they were going to sign Bonds or Maddox, and they considered Bonds and ultimately went with Maddox, and he breaks it down. He's actually has a really good book. It's a real quick, easy read, and it kind of talks about how he put the teams together and tweaking and, you know, losing and finally winning. Of all the Braves we've written books so far, I think his is the best. Smoltz's is pretty good. Smoltz was on the Sportscasters when he put out his book to talk about it, which was really fun. And the funniest thing he said was he talked about, like, being in college for, like, 10 minutes. He's like the Jeremy Roenick of baseball. He went to college, but, like, he got there and was like, yeah, no, I don't think so. I'm out. So he talked about that on the Sportscasters, but yeah, a very cool Braves team. Curt Schilling, unfortunately, just crushed them. And I think, you know, I guess the negative to winning 104 games and having to go to game 162 to win the division is maybe they're a little bit out of gas in the playoffs. Maybe.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things where they were playing to win every single night from pretty much the All-Star break on. I mean, they were right. They were 10 games back at a certain point behind the Giants, and the Giants did have slippage in the second half. But, I mean, like I said, they had to win 51 out of 69 just to win the division by one game. So you're going at such a frenetic pace down the stretch. And I think in baseball, that hurts more than a sport like hockey, where I think kind of natural momentum takes over and you see, you know, upsets like in the NHL playoffs. But that's a story for another time.
And I think it really hurt them, too, is they win game one, which for whatever reason was in Philadelphia. I don't remember what the
They would alternate between the Eastern and the Western division. It was I always wondered why they would do it that way instead of based on record. They would always say, well, so we could plan the hotels. And it's like, okay,
right,
whatever. That's a lame excuse.
It's a very 1990 thing, right? I mean, but they tied game one in the ninth inning, I remember, and then lost in the 10th inning. And I think that was kind of like just kind of a crushing blow, you know? Like, I wonder, I mean, obviously Maddux was great in game two, and I think they won that by a million. And then I'm pretty sure they won game three. I want to say that was Glavine won that one. I should just look this up instead of trying to do
they
it
actually
by memory.
Did. Yeah, they had a 2-1 lead.
Yeah.
And they were home for four, and they lost a couple one-run games, although game five, again, was one of those infamous Mitch Williams blown save deals where...
Yeah, that was another one where they caught him in the third. Yeah, that happened, or in the ninth. That happened twice in this series.
Yeah, and Curt Schilling won the series MVP despite not actually winning any games because Mitch Williams kept blowing it. And Curt, and not to turn this into like a 93 Phillies or Curt Schilling bitch fest, but like him having the towel over his head, like demonstrative for the TV cameras, pissed off a lot of his teammates.
I remember that shot. That's an iconic
Mitch
shot.
Mitch Williams sure as hell hasn't forgotten that.
Sean McDonough and I talked about... I feel like an asshole kind of name dropping like this. It's Schmaltz and not McDonough. But when McDonough was on one of the years, I always get the Monday Night Football play-by-play man every year. ESPN sets that up for me, although they hid him from me this year because they were afraid of criticism. But the one year McDonough was on, we were kind of talking about his baseball stuff and his call of the Joe Carter home run after this. And we talked about this series, and he mentioned kind of just the iconic shot of Schilling in the dugout with a towel over his head. I'll never forget that. But yeah, that's a fun team. That's a fun team to think about. I actually considered them for my list, and then I saw that they were kind of on yours, and I'm like, we'll get to talk about them anyway. I had like a list of like 15 other teams that could have been 10, you know? But anything else about the 93 Braves? We'll talk more about that group in general. But yeah, you want
to
finish them out?
To your point about, you know, rooting for a baseball team that is winning, you're speaking to somebody who cheered for the 47 and 115 Baltimore Orioles of last year and who listened to like every game religiously on the radio, even up to like, you know, the last weekend of the season. That's how pathetic I am. OK,
are they going to get that many wins this year?
I think they're going to get to... I think they're going to get to at least 49. The race that I have in my head is, will the Orioles win more games than the Boston Bruins despite having the advantage of playing 80 more games, which they didn't do last year. It was 50-47, but we'll see how it goes this year. The Bruins won 49 games. If you count playoffs right now as we tape this, they're at 62, and I can tell you this Orioles team ain't getting anywhere close to 62 wins. So, yeah. So what is your number nine?
Yeah, let's stick with baseball. Another fun team. And my number nine is the 1989 Oakland Athletics. And here's the thing about baseball fandom in Buffalo, especially when I was growing up. There wasn't a lot on TV, right? Like, we got to watch Braves on TBS, and you get to watch whatever ESPN, where they have a few games a week maybe at that point. I don't think ESPN2 was a thing yet. So you just had the main ESPN channel. And there was that Saturday morning show, which I lived for, like This Week in Baseball, which I loved. And here's what I really liked about this A's team is they had the Rookie of the Year in three straight years. They had Canseco, McGuire, and Walt Weiss won the Rookie of the Year. And there was something about, you know, 6-, 7-year-old, 8-year-old me that was really into that. And they were a fun team. And I used to love, and I don't know, I think baseball is missing the boat. I know this will never happen again, but I used to love coming home from school in October, still nice outside, and having an ALCS championship game on. And then whether it was against Toronto or whoever they were playing, or the Red Sox maybe one year, just a really fun team to watch, and I got really into them. And then, of course, there's that night, right? How much of the game can I watch tonight? It's the World Series. You negotiate that 1 hour. And it starts, and all of a sudden there's an earthquake, right? And then instead of just me begging for an hour in front of the TV, it's like the whole family, I think we sat there for 3 hours, you know, and then the World Series gets delayed for, what was it, 15 days? Something long, and there's another great 30 for 30 about it. And then the A's finally finish off the sweep and finally get a World Series after, you know, losing in 88 on the, well, not on the Grand Slam, but of course the Grand Slam, or excuse me, Canseco hit a Grand
Slam.
Two-run
homer fight.
Right, Canseco hit a Grand Slam to give the lead.
In that game, yeah.
Right, in that lead, and then Gibson hits the home run, the iconic home run to win it. And then they lose that series to the Dodgers. And then in 90, they lost, got swept by the Reds, which was a huge upset. And that was about it for that team. But, yeah, really fun team. The 89 A's with McGuire and Canseco and Walt Weiss, the three straight Rookie of the Year award winners, and Dave Stewart and Bob Welch, and, of course, Eckersley, and his emotion and fun recording the last out in San Francisco on the ground ball, which he picked up and tossed over to first base, which I remember clearly. So, anything on the 89 A's from you?
Well, I mean, this was a team with a nice mix of young guys like McGuire and Canseco, although Canseco missed a lot of that year in 89. He's back for the playoffs to hit one in the Sky Dome that I don't think, well, clearly it did land at some point because they put a marker in the Sky Dome, which I feel is kind of embarrassing to do for an opponent home run.
That was a bomb,
like,
though.
The longest home run, yeah. I mean, they steamrolled through the playoffs, five games against Toronto, and then you had the interruption in the World Series. But they were clearly going to outclass the Giants. The Cobra Dave Parker was on that team as well, and actually still a contributor, you know, kind of picking up the Canseco slack because he I hope you're sitting down. Jose Canseco in a lot of the season. I can't believe it. And Parker was the DH. They got Ricky Henderson back in midseason from the New York Yankees, which – does anybody ever think of Ricky Henderson as a Yankee? He was with a lot of different teams, but you just think of him as he is the Oakland A's. I mean,
yeah, I think of him as an A. They also had Dave Henderson on that team, right? Red Sox hero.
And that would, you know, that would always kind of following the Red Sox at that time. And, you know, in 89, they had a really bad mix in their clubhouse of, you know, guys that just like turned on each other. And Dave Henderson was always a happy-go-lucky guy. And the fact that they got rid of him the year after that Red Sox run, well, you know, maybe we'll get to the 86 Red Sox later. Actually, no, I didn't put them on my list. Wow, that might have been an oversight. Anyway.
Rest in peace, Buckner, yeah, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Dave Stewart, the ace of that staff, a guy who, I mean, Eckersley got all the headlines because he was damn near perfect as a closer that year. Because I think that's the year he had, like, yeah, he had three walks in 57 innings that year.
Wow.
Three walks the entire season. But Dave Stewart, an intimidator on the mound, he's not anybody who was ever going to get a Hall of Fame consideration. But in my mind as a kid, I was like, holy crap, Dave Stewart is a god. Because every single time he would face the Red Sox, the rotations would line up that it would be him versus Roger Clemens. And he would just outpitch Clemens every single time. And this happened like 8 or 9 times where it officially became a, quote, a thing in Boston where, oh, Roger Clemens can't pitch against Dave Stewart anymore. Maybe we should switch up the rotation. But Dave Stewart was just a great big game pitcher. And, you know, I enjoyed that team quite a bit myself, I have to say.
Interesting fact about the three straight American League championship teams. The only team not to win 100 games was the 89 team, which won 99, won the World Series, 104 in 88 and 103 in 90, and of course losing the World Series those years. And a quick note about the Giants, who they beat in the World Series. One thing I'll never forget about them is they beat the Cubs in the NLCS, and I remember Will Clark hitting a grand slam in that series, which really sticks out. And just feeling bad for the Cubs, because, you know, like, that was the first time in my lifetime that the Cubs, that I realized that they were the lovable losers, you know, and that they were, that they got within 4 games of a World Series, which they hadn't been to since, you know, almost 100 years already at that point. So I do recall that. I recall, like, the sadness of Will Clark's home run, like, hitting the stands in Wrigley Field and thinking, like, oh, it's too bad for them. But
when you break it down, 1989 was a really weird baseball season. Just from, I mean, you had the Pete Rose thing just hanging over everything for the entire year, And it just seemed like a lot of weird stuff was happening. So it was fitting that there was an earthquake interrupting the World Series. I mean, the commissioner dropped dead a week after banning Pete Rose from baseball and all that. So, I mean, I'm surprised. Well, maybe there is a book written about the 1989 baseball season that somebody's done. I've read books about various other seasons, like 1976. So any aspiring baseball authors out there, maybe you want to write a book about 1989 baseball season.
I always tell Perlman he should do a book about these A's teams, you know, like he did the Mets 86 team. Or I mean, maybe you don't pick a year, you just do it about this era of the A's. But yeah, crazy season, crazy team, crazy scores in the World Series too. They won Game 3 at Candlestick Park 13-7. Do you remember where you were? Did you see the earthquake happen in real time like I did? Or?
Yep, I remember exactly where I was in the house that I grew up. I was standing in like the TV was like in the sun parlor, and I was like standing in like the awning, like kind of like leaning up thing watching, and all of a sudden you hear like, and like you could hear Al Michaels immediately recognize, we're having an earthquake, because Al is just a total pro. And like, we'll keep his composure. And what it goes to the graphic that says World Series, ABC, all that. And when they get the audio back, Al Michaels is like, wow, that is the greatest open in the history of television, bar none. And he just kind of throws it to commercial. And, you know, the whole thing kind of plays out from there.
I remember there was like a delay where they were deciding what to do. And like part of an episode of Roseanne aired, and then,
yeah,
which was really weird. Like, I just remember that. And then I was about to like go to bed because they were on Roseanne, and I wanted to bank the time for like the game tomorrow instead. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, well, I'll go to bed early tonight because they'll probably play tomorrow. And of course that didn't happen. And then I'm pretty sure when the A's won it, it was on a Saturday night. So I didn't have to worry about that. But, yeah, crazy. So that's my number 9, the 89 A's, the one World Series champion, and that Bash Brothers crew. Really fun team. What do you got for number 9?
All right, for number 9, this is probably going to blow some people's minds. So like, why would you have this team on your list? My number 9 is the 1990 Cincinnati Bengals.
That is very odd. Yes, correct.
Now, I don't think this has ever come up on my podcast, or I don't think I've talked about this really publicly, that at one time I had a very deep interest in the Cincinnati Bengals. And let me explain why. If you rewind to the late 80s and you think about football in the New England area, yes, the Patriots existed, but they were kind of teetering out of control with an unstable ownership situation. Either the ownership was quickly going bankrupt because they bankrolled a Michael Jackson concert tour with his brothers and didn't bother to put a cap on the expenses like the Sullivans did, who then sell it to Victor Kiam, who was just an embarrassment from the word go, harassing female reporters. I mean, Kiam could probably end up at a certain website that shall remain nameless, given some of the things that he did. And then the team ends up in the control of the NFL for a year, and then ends up being sold to James Bush Orthwine, who tries to move the team to St. Louis, and Bob Kraft steps in. So during this time period, in around the 87, 88, 89 period, I took this interest in the Cincinnati Bengals for a variety of different reasons, as it always tends to be. You know, the color scheme, black and orange, is, you know, the same scheme as the city that I grew up in. I liked Boomer Esiason. I liked Sam Weish. I liked his style as the coach of the Bengals. Very, very brash. And there's a lot that goes into this. And it's not just because the 1990 Cincinnati Bengals are the team that's in Tecmo Super Bowl for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And that is the year that is the NFL year with the teams in there. So the Patriots are terrible and the Bengals are a pretty interesting team. And you think, when you think of the Bengals teams from the late 80s and into 90 and 91, you think of Icky Woods, but he was barely even there because after his rookie year, he got hurt. So you're looking at like other guys like Eddie Brown, Tim McGee, even Collinsworth was gone after the eight. So it was like a whole new crew of guys. It was not so much superstars. It was a team that was innovative in some ways. Like they were running the no huddle offense before the Buffalo Bills were.
Well, hold on. Where, that's the same year.
Well, 88. Okay, so 88, the Bengals are running the no huddle. And as I understand
they beat the Bills NFL, that year in the NFC or the AFC Championship game, yeah.
Yes, the NFL stepped in at some point. There was a playoff game against Seattle that year. It was the divisional round, and Seattle was faking injuries all over the field to kind of slow down the no huddle.
Yeah, I remember that, actually.
Talking about the 88 team rather than the 90 team, but they actually banned the no huddle for the game against Buffalo, ironically enough, given how Buffalo would rise to prominence. And they, you know, and the NFL apparently regretted doing that. But this 1990 team is fascinating from a lot of different perspectives, one of which the AFC Central from that era of 88 through 91, let's say, was so crazy because not only did the teams hate each other and the fans hated each other, but the coaches hated each other too. Sam Weish hated Jerry Glanville of the Oilers, who hated whoever the hell was coaching the Browns, Schottenheimer, and then it was, you know, Bud Carson. And then you got Chuck Knoll, you know, the "I am so pious because I won the Super Bowl 12 years ago" kind of guy. But Sam Weish would just like throw it back in their faces. It wasn't in 90, but in 89, there was a game against Houston. And this is how much he hated Jerry Glanville. That they're up 58-7 with like 5 seconds left. Sam Weish calls timeout so that they can make a field goal and get 60. Wow. And win 61-7. Like, that was the extent of the rivalry between all those teams. In 89, every single one of those teams finished 8-8 or better. Three of them were 9-7. Bengals finished 8-8, so they actually ended up on the outside when it came to the playoffs. But this team in 90, the 90 Bengals are kind of notoriously remembered for, they're the last Bengals team to actually win a playoff game, which was the week before Kevin Walker's tackle on Bo Jackson.
The last team to ever play him. You know, while we're there, I should mention that because I was watching that game because the Bills were going to play the winner of that game, obviously, Cincinnati and the Raiders. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I remember about it is Bo Jackson limping off the field and them kind of speculating, would he be ready for Buffalo? But he never played again.
Yes. Yeah. I know. I remember they're like, well, he's questionable for this week. And I thought, oh, Bo's going to play because it's the AFC Championship. But it turned out to be like a hip pointer. And then like, oh, no, it's not a hip pointer. This is much, much, much more serious than that, where it like derailed his baseball career and everything. I mean, he was obviously never the same. One more thing I got to point out about the 1990 Bengals that is insane and that I completely forgot about is they played 5 consecutive road games in the month of October.
Yeah, that would never happen again, right? I mean,
because in the NFL, they generally do not schedule it for more than three. Home or in a row. That in this case, what had happened was they had a thing in the schedule where they had 2 road games and then a home game and then 2 more road games. Well, the home game in the middle, they had to move that game to Houston because there was going to be a conflict potentially with the National League Championship Series.
Wow. With the Reds.
Which is funny. Yep.
Yeah, wow.
And they couldn't convert the stadium in time, which left me scratching my head. I was like, really? Like, that's why you build like that circle stadium. So if you play the baseball on Saturday, you can't convert it to football on Sunday. Well, as it turned out, the Reds series was over like 2 days before, but because they had to move the game to Houston with way more advanced notice than that, they got stuck playing 5 road games in a row. They went 2-3, but they ended up winning the division with a record of 9-7. Like I said, that division was very competitive, so 9-7 would actually, because they would just beat the hell out of each other.
Right, and actually Houston beat them in the regular season 48-17 in one of the games, And then when they played in the playoffs, it was almost a reverse score. 40. Well, 40.
Yeah, the Bengals,
it was a
Bengals
split.
Pulled them out of the playoffs, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was a split in the regular season, which each winning team getting 40, and then the Bengals blew them out in the playoffs. So, yeah, crazy rivalry. Crazy. That's a team I haven't thought about, to be honest, in a long time, but I always remember them for that being the last team to ever play Bo Jackson. And, yeah. Yeah, clearing him out for the Bills. And also the Saints did beat that 1990 Bengals team, if I recall correctly, too.
Yes, they did. Yep.
So if I remember that right. But interesting team. Very interesting. Let me read a list that we got from a listener. Actually, a friend of mine named Josh Cormier, really good dude, big Red Sox fan, was at the Aaron Boone game 7, and he told me the funniest thing about it. He's like, "Steve, I'm not kidding. I was in the parking lot before the ball hit the ground." He's like, "We got out of there so fucking fast." But here's his list. Number 10, the 1988 Notre Dame football team. Number 9, the 1999 Buffalo Sabres Stanley Cup team. Number 8, the 1993 Buffalo Sabres. Maybe we'll talk about them later. Number 7, 2018 Notre Dame football. Number 6, the 1990 Buffalo Bills, the team we were just talking about. Number 5, the 2006 Buffalo Sabres. Number 4, the 2013 Boston Red Sox. Number 3, the 2012 Notre Dame football team. That's the team that got killed by Alabama. Number 2, the 1992 Buffalo Bills. And number 1, of course, probably number 1 on any Red Sox fans list, the Idiots, the 2004 Red Sox. Shout out to my buddy Josh, a really good dude. And actually, we went to Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals that Danny Briere scored in overtime together. So, shout out to Josh. Thanks for the list, bud. And are we moving on to my number 8, or do you have any comments on Josh's list?
I just one comment. I'm fascinated by the inclusion of the 1992 Buffalo Bills as the... Because that team, if I recall, did not even win the AFC East. They got in as a wild card and had to go to Miami.
Isn't that the team that had the comeback game? Is that why?
Yeah, now that I think about it, yeah, they were the team that came back against Houston, yeah. So now it makes total sense.
That's probably why.
Yep.
All right, shout out to Josh. My number 8, maybe a surprise, because I could have went with a championship team here, but I went with the 2008-2009 Oklahoma Sooners football team, slightly edging out the 2000 team that won the national championship against Florida State. And I think was that the second or the third BCS championship game? Second or third? I know Tennessee won the first one. I can't remember if there was someone between Tennessee and OU, but one of the early BCS games.
The Oklahoma in 2000 was the third BCS title game. And the reason why I remember that is in 97, they had the split between Nebraska and Michigan, which prompted the BCS title game in 98, which was won by Tennessee because Peyton
first
Manning
year post
left.
Peyton. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
Had left. So
who won in between OU and Tennessee? Do you remember that?
In 99, Florida defeated Va Tech.
Gotcha. Oh, that's right. Michael Vick versus Peter Warwick.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I remember that game now. All right. So I just love this 2008 and this OU team. They were awesome. Sam Bradford was like, you know, the main man on the team. And they were really fun to watch. And Sam Bradford, you know, obviously a Hall of Famer in the business of football. Maybe not an NFL Hall of Famer, but in the business of football, a Hall of Famer. But in college, way before he had that money and those injuries and the reputation that he has now, man, was he a gamer. Just a badass quarterback who sacrificed leg and limb against Oklahoma State trying to get a touchdown. And this team lost the Texas game. And I don't know if you remember this, but Texas Tech was really good that year and thought that they were going to come into Oklahoma and beat Oklahoma. And it was on ABC, the night game, and Oklahoma slaughtered them 65-21. And ultimately what happened was a three-way tie in the Big 12. And the tiebreaker was the BCS standings. and Oklahoma had the highest BCS ranking. So they were awarded the Big 12, like that division. Like, so Oklahoma, Texas Tech, and Texas are all in the same, we're all in the same division of the Big 12. So because Oklahoma had the best BCS ranking, they got to play Missouri in the Big 12 championship game. They won that 62-21 and went on to play Tim Tebow in Florida in a really exciting national championship game. It's kind of overlooked. People think, oh, typical Bob Stoops, can't win a big game. But that game was right there going into the fourth quarter. And I think the difference was the buildup to that was all about Percy Harvin and DeMarco Murray were both injured and questionable for the game. And Percy Harvin played and DeMarco Murray unfortunately didn't, because his injury was actually a lot worse than Oklahoma was letting on. He was never going to play in that game. He had a broken kneecap in the Big 12 championship game. But Murray didn't play, Harvin did, and Harvin made some huge plays in the fourth quarter, and ultimately 4-1. But just an awesome OU team. I just really love to watch them. They scored a ton of points. Listen to the points they scored in their wins.
716 points.
Yeah.
Over 14 games. 51.1 per game. That is, I mean, one of my critiques of college football is a little too much scoring, but I'm sorry, 51 points a game is freaking impressive by any standard.
Yeah, they were awesome, super fun to watch. And the 2000 team was fun to watch too, but I had just become, well, okay, so the reason I like Oklahoma football at all is because I grew up with a kid named Pete Orfanis, who actually was a star high school football player in Western New York, and instead of taking a full ride to Penn State or Syracuse, he walked on to OU and ended up being Jason Belzer's backup, and eventually they moved into scholarship. But he didn't really play a ton. He did play in a Gator Bowl and mostly spent his career backing up Jason Belzer. But so then we became really good friends right around, like, I knew Pete when he went to OU, but he was older than me, obviously. And we became good friends. We were working at the same hockey rink together. And he invited me to watch the 99 team play Notre Dame. And it was Stoops' first year, and they lost. And then we just started watching all the games together. So I watched a ton of OU games with Pete, and that's where it kind of really started for me. But I wasn't as all in 2000 as I was by the time, you know, I got to 2009 and Sam Bradford. And then the last couple of years, I just had to make a decision. Like, I can't be all in on Saturday and Sunday. I just can't. So I still love OU, and I still watch the games, but I keep them at a little bit of an arm's length because I just can't quite be like, I couldn't, if I was as into OU 2 years ago as I was in 2008, I may have died that winter with them losing the way they lost to Georgia and the Saints losing the way they did to Minnesota. Like,
yes,
I may have been dead. So I keep them a little bit at an arm's length. But man, I loved this team, and it's too bad they couldn't have made a couple more plays in the fourth quarter and beaten Florida, because I think if they would have, they would really be remembered a lot more fondly as one of the great teams in the BCS era. Anything on them from you?
No, I mean, just an amazing amount of points that team scored.
That's insane.
I think one thing that they might not have had going for them against a team like Florida is, you know, if you can't turn the game into a track meet, it can become a little difficult. But yeah, a lot of talent on that team. But then again, when it comes to college football, I'm a little in the dark on some things in the last 20 years.
Well, so, their captains, I mean, their offensive captain was Bradford and their defensive captain was Gerald McCoy. You know, I think the draft that followed this, they had like three of the top five picks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, an impressive arrangement of talent, and it's too bad. It's really too bad. And maybe this is sour grapes or excuses, but man, it's too bad that DeMarco Murray didn't get to play in that national championship game. We were all cheated a little bit by him not being there, just because he was such a stud. I mean, such a stud. After Adrian Peterson left, I thought, you know, they'll never have a player quite like him again. And DeMarco Murray was close, really close. So, all right, number eight, what do you got?
For my number eight, and my list is so decidedly non-provincial at the bottom half, but I was a huge fan of the star player of this team, the 1995 Houston Rockets that would go on to win the NBA championship, despite having a record of 47-35, which is, you know, pretty bad for an NBA champion. In fact, I think it's certainly the worst record by an NBA champion in my lifetime. Usually you see teams, they have to win 55, 60, 65 games to have a chance to win the title. That team won the title as a six seed in the Western Conference. So they never had home court in any playoff series. Now, like I had said, you know, I'm not very strong on college football the last 20 years. Now, Steve, you told me with the NBA at pretty much any juncture, you're not exactly...
Well, this is probably my best era. This is probably my best era. Like, from, if I know anything about the NBA, it's from, you know, the start of the Pistons run to the end of Jordan's run in 98.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe a little bit of the Shaq Kobe stuff. Look, I always know enough to be able to handle a conversation, but if you ask me who the sixth man off the bench on the 95 Rockets, I have no clue. You know what I mean? What I think I remember about this team is that Drexler played on this team, right?
They got Drexler in the middle, kind of a peculiar move because I don't want to say he didn't fit a need. It just felt weird because they didn't feel like a championship contender at certain points during the season. They actually lost 16 of their last 28 to end the year. And Olajuwon had a few injury issues during the season, and he was undoubtedly the, you know, straw that stirs the drink with that team, because you had Olajuwon up here, and I guess Drexler filled that void as the sort of, you know, number two guy on that team. But what they had, and their whole thing was Clutch City in their, championship video. They had so many guys step up. Now, Robert Horry became famous later on with the Spurs and the Lakers for making big shots in the playoffs. But this is where he started doing it, with these two Rockets teams that won back-to-back. Sam Cassell stepping in at point guard when Vernon Maxwell, as I recall, kind of went insane at a certain point, because I don't remember him contributing at all. Mario Elie hitting big shots from the corner in the playoffs.
Yeah, they were the sixth seed in this playoff. Wow.
It's the greatest playoff run by any team in my lifetime in terms of the level of difficulty and the odds that they had to overcome in order to win a championship. In the first round, they're playing Utah. And back then, the NBA was a best of five first round. They were down.
They should still 2-1. Be, by the way. They should have never.
It would save everybody a lot of time and trouble. They played Utah in the first round. They were down 2-1, and they won game four at home, and then won a dramatic game five in Utah to topple Stockton and Malone. Go to the next round. They play the Phoenix Suns, Charles Barkley. You know, they're 2 years since making the final, but Phoenix goes up 3-1. I believe they actually won the two games in Houston, games 3 and 4. Houston comes back, wins game 5 in Phoenix, wins game 6 at home, and then yet another dramatic game 7. A big
kiss
shot
of death. I remember that.
The aforementioned Mario Elie was the hero in that one. And then the series against the Spurs is one of the more, in the Western Conference Final, one of the more peculiar series in NBA history, because When you look at like NBA results for the playoffs for almost any year, it's like, oh, this is so boring. Like, you don't talk about chalk in the NCAA tournament. In the NBA, like, the home team, it's like what feels like 98% of the games, to the point where it just becomes, you know, straight up boredom. In the 95 Western Conference Finals, the road team won the first five games of that series. So Houston went in, won 2 in San Antonio, and San Antonio goes and wins 2 in Houston. But it was game 5 where David Robinson gets presented with the MVP award for the 94-95 season by David Stern. Hakeem Olajuwon is watching this, and he goes out, and I think he puts up 40-20 against David Robinson on that night, leads them to a win. They take game 6, but they go to the final. They're playing the Orlando Magic, the upstarts, you know, Nick Anderson, Dennis Scott, and, of course, Shaquille O'Neal. So that's the big matchup for Olajuwon, which was no problem for him, although that series was a little bit closer than what might be remembered because it ended up in a sweep. Orlando was up by 20 in game one, and Kenny Smith made a big shot to send the game to overtime, and a putback by Olajuwon wins that game. And they never look back. And the fact that they swept that Orlando team, that pretty much ended any thought of the Orlando Magic being a championship viable going forward, because Shaq is gone after the next season. Nick Anderson is never the same after missing those free throws at the end of game one, where he had four consecutive free throws. If he had made any of them, it would have sealed the game because they had a 3-point lead. But yeah, that 95 Rockets team, such a resilient bunch, well coached by Rudy Tomjanovich. I really can't say enough about them, how they overcame what was undoubtedly kind of a crappy regular season for them and took down four very, very strong teams to win a second consecutive title.
Yeah, wow. And that Orlando team, there's a cool documentary made about them. I want to say it was an NBA Network production. They've made a few cool documentaries on the NBA Network, and they talk a lot about, maybe it was a 30 for 30. I don't know. It was one of the two. But, they were one of the few teams post-90 to beat Michael Jordan in the playoffs, right? I mean, he had just come back for the playoffs, and they beat them in the second round, so that's kind of a cool thing.
Well, I mean, that team is funny because Shaq was the number one pick in 92, and then they get the number one pick in 93, and they trade it, you know, for Penny Hardaway, which seemed like a good idea at the time. But, man, I wish that they had just drafted Chris Webber, paired him with Shaq, and they would have just ruled the rest of the 90s. I don't care how good Penny Hardaway was. That was the duo that I wanted to see. So, karmically, they deserved what they had. They deserved what they got for trading that pick, because they didn't really do much with the three first-rounders that they got anyway.
All right. My number seven, if you are done with the Houston Rockets.
Yes, I am.
All right. Yep. My first of three New Orleans Saints teams. I have been a diehard New Orleans Saints fan since their playoff loss to end the 1987 season. I watched the game with my father. He told me their history. And I watched them storm out to a lead and then die a slow, miserable death to the Minnesota Vikings. And I was hooked for life. Ironically, my first ever game in the Superdome was against the Minnesota Vikings because of 9/11. I guess it would have been... No, because of 9/11. Because what happened was, they opened the season.
I don't know where you're going with this.
Okay, just real quickly, I'll tell the story. So they opened the season in Buffalo on Sunday.
Right.
I go to that game. Then Monday, I watch Monday Night Football, go to sleep, and then Tuesday, wake up, and 9/11 happens. I was supposed to go to the Saints game that weekend in New Orleans to see them raise the championship banner of the NFC West. Those games got rescheduled for like week 17.
Right.
So the Saints were nice enough to switch my tickets to the first home game because I told them I really wanted to see, you know, the banner. So it ended up being a Vikings game. All right. But anyway, I actually wanted to put the 2000 Saints on. Wanted to maybe consider one of the 90s teams with the Dome Patrol, and maybe one of those make it later. But the first entry to the New Orleans Saints team is the 2011 Saints, maybe the most dominant team of the Breeze and Peyton era. It's either that team or the two others that are on this list, so we'll get to those. But just an unbelievable team that won a ton of games in a row. I don't remember how many, but it was a lot in the middle of the season. And then they beat the Lions in the wild card round, because despite winning 13 games, or maybe it was 12 games, they did not get a bye. The 49ers and the Packers, who won 15 games that year, were the two bye teams in the NFC. So a tough NFC, maybe some bad luck there. And then they lost in the second round of the playoffs, in the division round, for the second season in a row. They lost a playoff game that got named. This one was catch three against the 49ers, which I remember after the Saints team lost this game, I remember just sitting down in my chair and turning to my wife and saying, like, well, they lost a classic. What are you going to do? Right? That was a classic game. There was like 5 lead changes in the fourth quarter. They spotted the 49ers 17 points to start the game. They're lucky to even be in it. And I kind of handled it well. I actually had Kenny Albert. I interviewed Kenny Albert the next day on the podcast. He had called the game for Fox, kind of really handled it like a man, you know. But to see a 13-3 team go out, and then what made that even harder is an assistant on the Packers' son committed suicide that week. And the Packers just had a really bad week and ended up losing. You know, so if they could have won that game, they would have hosted the NFC Championship game against the Giants. And again, maybe played a Super Bowl against Tom Brady and the Patriots. There's a lot of close calls for the Saints.
Well, I have some bad news. I have some bad news for you.
Okay.
They would have lost to the Giants because there is no God. I regret to inform you that there is no God. And if there was, well, he has been overpowered by this alliance of Eli Manning and the devil that took place in 2007 and 2011. They to kind of back up your point, they went 13-3. They won their last eight games of the season. So they roll into the playoffs. They had a 9-game winning streak. And I remember that game against the 49ers because I was over at a friend's house waiting for the Patriots, and I think it was Denver, was to be that night. It was the Tim Tebow Broncos versus the Patriots. And the end of the Saints 49ers game is going on, and they're just going back and forth down the field. I feel like, you know, neither team could get a stop. I remember Alex Smith running for, what was it, like a 30-yard touchdown?
Yeah, freaking bootleg. Ugh.
And, you know, I had no real rooting interest. I guess it was a 28-yard run. I had no real rooting interest in this game because in the divisional, it's not like you're more worried about your team.
Right. You're not projecting it out then just yet. And everyone thought it'd be the Packers anyway. So, I mean, the Packers were the dominant team of that season. They won 15 games.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the crazy thing with this one is just how, you know, I mean, the Saints couldn't get a stop on the 40. I mean, they let, you know, like I said, they let Alex Smith. Yep. Alex Smith. We're not talking about Michael Vick or Steve Young here. Run 28 yards, you know, up the left side. But then the Saints score like right afterwards
on a Jimmy Graham touchdown. Yeah.
Yep. To retake the lead, and you know they get the lead out to 3 points, but then they just allow the 49ers to march down the field. Now I'm an Alex Smith guy. I like him a lot more than other people do. But your team should be able to get a stop.
Or at least hold them to a field goal.
On him.
Right? At least hold them to a field goal and get the game to overtime. At least.
Exactly. But then again, I say that as the fan of a team that got burned by Eli Manning twice. So what can I really say about that?
Yeah. But the Saints take the lead on a 9-play, 79-yard drive, 3 minute and 34-second drive. Then San Francisco takes the lead on the 28-yard touchdown that Smith had. Then that, when we say then, the Jimmy Graham touchdown. And then a 7-play, 85-yard drive in 1:28 to Alex freaking Smith, which is capped by the Vernon Davis catch, a kid that was like thrown off the field by Mike Singletary a year ago. You know, makes his, I mean, he ended up being better from that point on, kind of gave him his confidence. But yeah, a tough way to go out, but really a Saints team that I just loved to watch them. Another thing I loved about this team is Peyton really stuck it to the Falcons by leaving Drew Brees on the field to break Dan Marino's record against the Falcons at home, because they didn't want to play him the following week. And that really, that really pissed the Falcons off. And anything that pisses the Falcons off is fine with me. So that was pretty awesome. I think Darren Sproles is the one who caught the Drew Brees pass short middle to D Sproles 9-yard touchdown. Brees breaks single season passing yardage record. That was a 45-16 win, and that was well into the fourth quarter. So the Falcons weren't pleased with that, but yeah. F the Falcons, an awesome Saints team. Drew Brees, Jimmy Graham, Darren Sproles. Remember, the Saints played in the first game of the season, the Thursday night game against the Packers that year. And Darren Sproles had like a 72 or 73, 80 yard, something like that, punt return in his first game as a Saint. And I thought, wow, this guy's going to really be good. And man, what a great season. And that team deserved better. But
that was
yeah.
a back and forth game, that Green Bay game as well, yeah. a very high scoring one where, you know, it's funny how their season got bookended by these high scoring games where their defense just couldn't make a play. And then right after the season ends is when the doomsday comes in. But
yeah,
I'm
that's
sure you don't
bullshit.
Want to talk
about yeah,
that
fuck now. That. It's ridiculous. that's good for me. We'll talk more about the Saints and all three of my Saints teams, you know, spoiler alert. Our Brees Peyton era. So we'll talk more about him as we go forward. But I did love that 2011, 12 team. They deserve better. Easily could have won the Super Bowl if they could have just gotten out of San Francisco. But they didn't.
Yep.
What do you got? Number seven for you, right?
My number seven is the 2004 Boston Red Sox, a very historic team. And somewhere in my basement, or maybe I took that down. I don't know. I had a Sports Illustrated that said, you know, team of the year, sportsman of the year or something. I guess I must have taken that down. Oh, no, it's right over there. I moved it. Yeah. Yeah. The whole team won sportsman of the year. So if you ever wondered, Curtis Laskanik, sportsman of the year, Mike Myers, sportsman of the year, even if you count the guys who played one game, Abe Alvarez, sportsman of the year. For the 2004 Red Sox, a team that was basically two different teams during the season, because the first half of the year, they were a sluggish 500 team that kind of had the form of Nomar Garciaparra as their avatar.
Right, him sulking in the dugout, right?
Well, that is the moment that everybody remembers. And by the way, fun story, when that game was taking place, the Jeter catch and Nomar sulking in the dugout. I was at a strip club that night. Very, very odd. Somewhat out of character for me. And I remember after the Yankees won in walk-off fashion, my friend, who shall remain nameless to protect his identity, went and just immediately went and got a lap dance with the first woman that he saw. I laughed for like five straight minutes. Like, well, that makes me feel better about that. So the first part of that season, they got Pokey Reese at shortstop, who, you know, is a wizard defensively, but really can't hit. And they're just struggling to get going, even though, you know, they have one thing that a good team needs, which is a healthy starting rotation. Pedro Martinez stayed healthy the entire year. Schilling was healthy. Derek Lowe was healthy, although he pretty much sucked for much of the year with an ERA of around five. So when they got to the playoffs, they were very hesitant to use him. The ballsy trade of Nomar to the Cubs and then getting Cabrera and Doug Mankiewicz, I'm pretty critical of Theo Epstein, or at the very least, I feel that, you know, some of the things that he's done, oh, a little overblown. I mean, He's basically been the general manager of two franchises that have every institutional advantage that Major League Baseball has to offer.
That's fine, but also nobody with those advantages could win a World Series in either spot for significant stretches of time until he showed up, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. Although I don't think the Cubs knew how to leverage their advantages until more recent years, because I think, weirdly, I think that whole day game thing, you know, kind of hurt them in kind of a weird sense. So this Red Sox team, they don't really start taking the form that people remember until about the middle of August. And I remember there's one particular game, which I feel like this is what this podcast is about, for me to recall stupid shit, like the night Terry Francona decided to start Doug Mankiewicz at second base, where he had been a first baseman his entire career. It's like, hey, can you play second base? I don't know if Mark Bellhorn was hurt or whatever. And he's put in there at second base. And I seem to, maybe I'm crossing it up with something else, but he got like run over on the bases and held on to the ball. And maybe that galvanized them at that point. But they went on a winning streak. They went into New York and won a big game in September, getting to Mariano Rivera.
Oh, a big home run by Bill, right? Bill Miller.
Well, that was that. Okay, that was the home game in July.
Okay,
with the infamous Varitek and A-Rod fight,
right?
Which a lot of people think, well, the team got going by after that, but not really, because you know Nomar is still there at that point, and they're still sluggish for about another month. I actually got invited to go to that game, and I turned it down, which was a rather stupid decision. But given how hungover I was that day from the night before, I had a kegger at my house, and I was pretty hungover the next day. And I had to work at 7 in the morning for 2 hours. So I got up, threw up, and then went to work for 2 hours, and then came home. And some guests from my party were still at my house, unbeknownst to me. But back to this team. They catch fire towards the end of the year. They go through September. They're not going to catch the Yankees. Pedro Martinez is struggling against the Yankees. Fine, big deal. Who's your daddy? The playoff series against the Angels, it seemed like fait accompli. They won three straight there. That it never felt like any of that was in doubt. They were destined to play the Yankees yep. again after what had happened the year before in Game 7, and Aaron Boone, who was stupid enough to go play basketball and blow out his ACL in the offseason.
Creating the A-Rod opening.
Yep. And they... I don't know if people remember the Yankees, how the Yankees won those first three games. I mean, it's easy to remember the, you know, them losing. I wouldn't call it so much a... I mean, I guess you could call it a collapse, but, you know, the Red Sox played very well. It's not like the Yankees made six errors in every game. In that first game, it was either the first game or the second game, Mike Mussina took a no-hitter into the seventh inning, but yet the final score still ended up being like 8-7 or 10-9, which tells you
10-7 Mussina over Schilling. Yeah, Rivera with the save. Yep. And then of course game 3 yep. was 19 runs in Fenway Park.
And my friend Merrill went to that game because he was a 10-game plan holder, and I guess that game, the first ALCS home game, was what they would offer to those plan holders. And he was at my house, I think, before that game had even ended. And we sat on my porch, and we just kept reciting James Taylor lyrics from Fire and Rain back and forth to each other. Because here's this disaster of a season that is going to end likely at a sweep at the hands of the New York Yankees. Because, as I mentioned, Derek Lowe was terrible the entire season with ERA over 5. And he's going to start game 4 against the Yankees the next night. And, you know, the Yankees get out to a 2-0 lead on an A-Rod home run. But then, luckily, A-Rod kind of disappears for the rest of the series. And the way that played out, where you have the comeback in the ninth inning of that fourth game. I mean, it's 4-3, and Rivera's on the mound, and they're going for a sweep. And I remember like watching the game on television, and I'm actually on the roof of my house looking into the window, because it was like the Sun Parlor roof, and I'm looking in basically so I can smoke as I'm watching this game, because I am so incredibly nervous. And Roberts steals the base, for which I need to point out the similarities between the Dave Roberts steal and the Willie Mays Hayes steal in the playoff game in Major League.
Willie Mays Hayes here.
It's almost exactly the same play, where it's almost the exact same closeness in how much he was safe by. And in each case, there's a number 2 for New York applying the tag.
Unbelievable.
In both. So game 4, Ortiz hits the home run.
And then the underrated huge play of this series is the ground rule double that the Yankees hit in game 5. That if it's not a ground rule double, they score a run and probably win that game, or Rivera has to blow another save for them to lose it. I don't know. Can you get to Rivera back-to-back games? I don't know.
Absolutely. Although I do have to back up and point out that in game 4, because the Red Sox bullpen which was salvaged somewhat by Tim Wakefield volunteering to pitch garbage innings at Game 3, which is why Derek Lowe had to pitch Game 4. Curtis Laskanik had to get four or five outs in that game. Future Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, Curtis Laskanik. And that was like the last games, I think, that was the last game he pitched in his major league career, because he didn't get used for the rest of the playoffs. Game 5, as you said, the ground rule double. They were down 4-2 in the eighth inning.
Who is it, Tony Clark that hit that double, I think?
I think it was Tony Clark, a future terrible union president who would sell out his membership for pretty much anything. But that's a story for another time. Ortiz with the walk-off hit in that one. I mean, that one goes 14 innings, so now you're just blowing up bullpens.
Yeah, and the Yankees had nothing left by the time it got to Yankee Stadium pitching-wise.
I mean, I think having these games go to all these extra innings actually ended up benefiting the Red Sox in a weird way, because it really wore down the Yankees sort of, you know, will, although the Game 6 was a miracle with Schilling being able to pull it off on the which, you know, could he have just, you know, been a nice guy for the rest of his life rather than...
Yeah, it's too bad that matters.
People.
It's too bad, like, because so many people are political, and it's just because he's right-wing political that people don't like him. But, man, what a performance. You know what I mean? Like, forget the blood. Just, like, what a balls performance that is. I mean, what, they, like, stapled his ankle together so he could go out there and pitch that game?
Yeah, and... you know, in thinking back to that, I always wondered why the Yankees didn't try to bunt on him more, because that's what I was expecting.
So do I.
Make him feel the ball. Any player with any sort of speed would just bunt on him and make him move around and make him uncomfortable. And they never did it.
Now,
I don't know if that's a Joe Torre thing where, like, oh, we're old school and we played the game the right way and all this other Michigan's bullshit. I mean, I would have done that.
Dog, I mean, you need to bunt more. You need to bunt more, dog. That was a bad job, Mike. That was a bad job.
I don't want to kill him. I don't want to kill him, but...
That was a bad job. Yeah, I remember Francesa like saying, like, dog, we don't got any pitching left. Nothing left. Nothing in the tank. It's going to take a miracle, dog.
If you think Kevin Brown is going to go out there and pitch 6 quality innings in Game 7, you got nothing coming.
That's a bad job. That's a bad job by the Yankees. $200 million. They got no one for Game 7. That's a bad job, Mike. That's a bad job.
Thank you for allowing me to do my Mad Dog Russo impersonation.
We're terrible, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
We're not exactly sour shoes here, but still, it's fun to do.
Sour shoes on the Stern Show doing Mad Dog is great. So Game 7, once Ortiz hits the 2-run homer, I'm not all that worried once that happens, because the Red Sox had a guy thrown out at the plate in the first inning of Game 7 on basically a terrible send by the third base coach. I don't remember who it was. I don't retain that kind of memory. But Damon gets thrown out at the plate, but Ortiz then hits a home run on the next pitch. Like, okay, well, everything's going to be okay. And then Damon decides, you know what? I'm going to hit home runs on like the next two pitches that I see. And 6 RBI, and it's 8-0, or it's 8-1 before you know it. And it's just like a matter of time, and you're just counting it down like, all right. It's like in hockey, if your team is up 4-0, it's left, you're just waiting for the damn minutes to go by. Baseball,
we'll talk about that. We'll talk about four minutes left, 4-0 and waiting for minutes to kick off. We'll get to that.
But like, they put Pedro Martinez in the game in the 7th inning.
And A-Rod slapped the ball out?
That was Game 6.
Oh, is that Game 6?
When Arroyo comes out of the bullpen and Jeter's on first base and A-Rod hits a squibber. It's funny that the Bronson Arroyo Alex Rodriguez matchup of 2004 led to a brawl in July and to effectively tarnishing A-Rod's reputation forever with the slap. And I have to applaud the umpiring crew for getting together and actually getting the call right, which they had also missed a call earlier in the game where when Bellhorn hit the home run it clearly went over the fence and bounced back. And they got together and they called it a home run then. And it was a 3-run homer. It was the difference, ended up being the difference in the game.
Could you imagine how notorious that play would be if it was left as originally called and the Yankees came back and won that game? Like, that would forever have been known as, like, the A-Rods. Like, the Yankees would have this tarnished World Series that they won because A-Rod slapped the ball like a little girl out of the first baseman's hand. Like, thank God they got that right. You know, like, even the Yankees fans, I don't think, would have wanted to win that way.
Yeah, and the crew chief for that ALCS is the notorious Joe West. And he was the one who kind of, you know, got out ahead of this. So credit to him for all of his, you know, making himself the show, which I don't like from my officials. For all of that, at least he did get that right. So, and once you win the game 7, when they got to the World Series against the Cardinals, even though the Cardinals were a 100-plus win team that year, it really did not seem like the outcome was that much in doubt, especially when the Red Sox managed to win the first 2 games despite committing 4 errors in each game. I mean, once that happens, it kind of feels like, okay, you know, this thing is going to get wrapped up either in St. Louis or Game 6 back here. And then the 4th straight actually earned me a day off from work because I had made a bet with my boss. I said, if they sweep the World Series, and this was during, like, at the beginning of the ALCS, so even before they went down 3-0, if they sweep the ALCS, can I get a day off to, you know, for whatever? And he's like, sure. Well, then I actually had to work overnight when the Red Sox won, or actually I had to report to work 4 a.m. the next day to do deliveries out in Central Mass. So basically I just bought every single newspaper I could find. So, like, I have, like, the Greenfield News that just has the simple headline, Red Sox win World Series, which I had the feeling I thought was going to be more valuable than it was, but then they ended up winning 3 more, so it's kind of devalued the whole thing.
So I have two questions for you about this team.
Yeah.
The first one is, did you post anything in the Win It 4 thread on sonsofsamhorn.com before Game 7 against the Yankees? One of the coolest things to ever occur on the internet.
I did not. I've never been a member or poster there.
I think it's a book now. Like, I think they turned it into a book, the whole thread. But one of the coolest things on the internet, if anyone's interested, you can find out about it. Sons of Sam Horn. Someone just started the thread, Win It 4, and wrote about, like, you know, my grandma who was a fan since the 30s or whatever. And the second question is, did you go to the Duck Parade?
That is one of the parades that I have been to. I went to the 04 parade. I drove it the Saturday, and I drove in to Boston on Friday, and I found a free parking space out in Allston, and I stayed with a friend out there. And we went to the parade, and we were at by, like, where the Boston Public Library is, and we watched it from there. And the day of the parade is the only time I've ever been to the famous bar, the Casket Flagon, that is just outside Fenway Park, just beyond the left field wall. Only time I've ever been in the Casket Flagon was the day of the Red Sox World Series parade in 2004. And I'm probably going to keep it that way forever because, well, maybe only I find it interesting, but I don't really find any need to go back there.
Will you go to the Bruins parade if they win this year?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With bells on.
Awesome.
The 2011 was the last parade that I went to. I know Boston has won a lot, you know, such as the 2009 Boston University Terriers.
Yes.
Among other championships.
One of the great comebacks of all time. I hope that team's on your list. I don't know if they are.
I probably should have, but I wasn't, like, as invested in, like, the regular season of that team. But I have never been to a Patriots Super Bowl parade because I think I might have mentioned this somewhere that it always seems to be a blizzard the day after the Patriots win the Super Bowl. Probably, like, you know, God being angry with
right. They've had enough.
Whatever
God's
the hell
enough.
Is happening. That,
quick story. Quick story about the 09 Terriers since they're not going to come back up. So I worked hockey schools with a kid named Ben Camper, who played D1 at Colgate, and his younger brother was a star on that Miami team, a kid named Carter Camper, who actually who played for the Bruins as well for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So Carter Camper is a star on this team, and I know that Ben and his whole family are at this championship game. So Miami literally had a 2-goal lead in that game with less than a minute left. BU made it 3-2 inside of a minute with the goalie pulled. Mm-hmm. And with about four, me and Ben were texting back and forth that whole weekend. And with about 4 minutes left, he texted me and said, like, oh, you know, my whole family just came down. You know, everyone who was in the upper deck just came down to the lower deck for the celebration. He's like, so, you know, I'll talk to you another time. So, like, we weren't great friends or anything. I had just texted him, like, you know, on Wednesday or whatever, hey, good luck to your brother, good luck to your family, you know, whatever. And that, obviously, I never heard back from him. But, wow, yeah, 2 goals. And then a horrible way to win or lose, I guess, the BU overtime goal, which is a slap shot that got blocked about 20 feet from the net popped up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, is there anything left about the historic 2004 Red Sox to say?
Not really, although I think kind of, like I said, because the Red Sox have won 4 World Series in this century, I think their impact has been, I don't want to say diminished, but it doesn't feel quite the same as it once was. But then again, I'm not part of that fandom anymore, so maybe I'm just the jaded outsider.
All right, my number 6 team is the 1995 Atlanta Braves. My Braves team to make the list is the champion, of course. I had been with them, admittedly, since about 1990 or so. I like the Atlanta Braves for one reason. I could watch them every day. Really as simple as that. And, they were a good team that I could watch every day. And honestly, in Buffalo at that time, they were the only team I could watch every day. Because we didn't get Superstation here for the Cubs, so we didn't have them. We didn't have Yes yet, you know, Yes didn't exist, so we didn't get the Yankees. So they were the team I could watch every day, and I did, because I loved baseball in 1995 as a high schooler. And wow, was this a great team. Obviously, a little bit of the season is cut off because of the strike. Still, they went 90-54. And listen to Greg Maddux. Listen to his season. You ready for some numbers here?
Mm-hmm.
Greg Maddux went 19-2. With a 1.63 ERA, 10 complete games, 3 shutouts, 209 innings pitched, and you ready for a strikeout to walk ratio? How about 181-23?
And a lot of those complete games have actually been named now. That it's coined the term
the Maddux,
which is the complete game. I forget if it's under 100 pitches or under 90 pitches. I forget how that goes, but he had consecutive complete games under 88 pitches and under in June of that year, which you almost never see now, because you have to have incredible control to do that. I mean, just looking at his pitching game log from that year, he walked 2 batters on June 3rd. He didn't walk anybody else until after the All-Star break. I mean, that's insane.
What a season. One of the great pitching seasons of all time. Then the Braves, obviously, 95 is, I think, the first year with the wild card. They beat the Rockies in 4 games, then beat the Reds in 4 games to go to the World Series. And then in the World Series, which was against a really good Indians team, with a bunch of really good players. A great lineup of Baerga and Bell and Tomei, and just a really good team. And, of course, the infamous Dave Justice saying that the fans in Atlanta are a bust. And let's be honest, he was right. They can be very brutal. And he hits the home run in the 8th inning, and Glavin pitches the game of his life. Woolers gets a save, and the 90s Braves avoid being the 90s Bills and get a championship. A really cool team that dominated really the season from the jump. Maddux was the opening day starter, and he was the main man, 4th straight Cy Young Award. Just really cool. And I was, Dave Justice is probably my all-time favorite baseball player. Well, him and Maddux are. and I got to do a tweet interview with Justice in the early days of the Sportscasters, which was fun. And, you know, he said, yeah, the two biggest home runs of my career were the one against the Indians to win the World Series and the one in the 2000 ALCS against the Mariners to send the Yankees to the World Series. Dave Justice, cool fact about him, never missed the playoffs, entire career.
Really? Okay. When did he retire? What, 02? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. He, I think his last few years with the A's, obviously he's in Moneyball. You know, he's like,
yeah, 02, he made it with Oakland. I guess he would have missed it with the 90 Braves.
The 90 Braves, but, right.
From 91
on. From 91 on, yeah.
Yep. That 95 World Series is a very, I think it gets overlooked just because of, you know, where baseball was at that time.
Right, it's rebuilding itself. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people just did not. We're not into it because of the strike and coming off all of that. But that was a really good World Series that, if you'll recall, actually aired on two different networks.
Yep.
That alternated the games between ABC and NBC and this weird thing called the Baseball Network, that the only thing it had going for it was a really good theme song that they would play at the beginning. Probably only I remember. That is a long version of it on YouTube. 5-1 run game, World Series, which, you know, you get teams that the thing that Cleveland and Atlanta had in common, other than Native American nicknames, was sometimes when they would get into the playoffs, their bullpens would be called into question. And, you know, Jose Mesa, you get your Alejandro Peñas for the Braves, Mark Wohlers and other closers. But a very exciting World Series and, for the most part, very, very well pitched. That Cleveland team was dynamite. I think you might have actually undersold them because they won 100 games in a 144 game season.
Wow. Yeah, an awesome team. Awesome lineup.
Like, if you extrapolate that out, they probably win 112, so maybe they're not the 98 Yankees or anything like that, but there's something pretty close. And they ran over the Red Sox in the first round in what was a very bizarre playoff format that year, because they, you know, not to relitigate this, but it was kind of strange how the team with the best record in the American League played the team with the second best record in the American League. And then the team with the third best record played the wild card. I thought that was a little strange.
Well, it's because they had set up where you couldn't play anyone in your division in the first round, right? Is that why it happened?
In theory, the wild card was the Yankees. So the Yankees should have played Cleveland, and the Red Sox should have played Seattle. But they fixed this, I think, either a year or two later, because I think they had it like planned by division or something. And obviously in the other league, the Braves, I think, had the best record, and they played the wild card. So I don't know what was going on. Bottom line is baseball was kind of a mess in 1995.
Right.
But the Braves, you know, they got their World Series. And thank God, because I would not want people to talk about those teams like, well, they never won this and they never won that. I mean, you know, to do what they did. It's not unprecedented because the Yankees have had runs like that as well, but you know, it's a sustained run of excellence that's extremely rare.
Yeah, it would have been nice if they could have cashed one more in, but they didn't. But this was special, and I mean, the World Series was, like I said, great. Like you said, great. Oral Hershiser and Maddox had a really great Game 5, and yeah, what a cool season for the Braves. That. Just Greg Maddux with those numbers and that fourth straight Cy Young. And yeah, let me throw one more. Let me do one more list here. Actually, you know what? You go ahead with your number six.
Okay. My number six, speaking of sustained excellence, is the 2001 New England Patriots.
I'm surprised they're not higher, to be honest. But
well, here's why. I wasn't living here. I wasn't living in New England at the time. So it's a little bit different when you're living somewhere else. I was living in Northern Virginia. So I didn't get to necessarily see all the games because the Patriots were not a national team. Like, they weren't. Actually, when you live in Washington, D.C., it's one of those markets where the AFC game is going to be the Ravens and the NFC game is going to be the Redskins, mm-hmm. and then you're going to be stuck. You're going to be stuck with those games. And if you see something else, well, feel fortunate. So, like, I didn't really get to see. I don't even think I saw any of their games until they played the Rams in that Sunday night game, which was about the 10th game of the season.
I remember that team kind of sneaking up on me because they were on, you know, obviously that season the Saints played played them. And, you know, I just remember thinking, like, for a long time that that was probably going to be a win. And then they just beat the shit out of us. Like, just. And then that gave me hope because I hated the Rams so much back then. And that kind of gave me hope that, wow, maybe the Patriots can actually pull this off. And, you know, the Ty Law pick six is the play that sticks out from that Super Bowl for me. And obviously the winning field goal.
The Patriots-Saints game from that year is actually kind of historic because that was the week where Drew Bledsoe was cleared to return and declared healthy. And where Bill Belichick said, no, we're staying with Tom Brady, which was a pretty ballsy decision when you consider the fact that Drew Bledsoe had just signed a 10-year contract with the Patriots shortly before that, which in retrospect seems really insane considering that 10-year contract for anybody in football just seems like, I mean, I know that they're barely worth the paper they're written on, unless they have strong guarantees. But the fact that they had just signed him to that deal and were so readily, you know, willing to move on from him. Don't forget, Belichick, the first year, he's trying to rebuild the team because they were not left in a good place when Pete Carroll got fired. 5-11 the first year. They start out 0-2 on either side of 9-11 in that 1 week where there were no games played. And then Bledsoe gets hurt at the end of that second game, which, by the way, fun fact, when Bledsoe takes that hit by Mo Lewis, he actually played another series, which I had forgotten about until I rewatched that game on YouTube.
Yeah, it's like practically bleeding out, right? From the inside.
Yes, and he was out of it, so then they put Brady in. And he was, I mean, I think it was like a 10-3 final where the Jets won. So it was not a game that was any great shakes. That team was completely based around their defense and, you know, trickery on offense and running the ball and more kind of old school. But they were a team that won based on their defense, which was they had signed coming in that year a lot of what was termed during the time period, I don't know if they still use this term, middle class free agents. Not the guys that you give the big signing bonus to, but sort of that next wave, which was embodied by somebody like Mike Vrabel, who comes in, he's a Patriot for 8 years, a strong contributor as a linebacker, but not anybody who's going to be an all-pro or, you know, play in the Pro Bowl or anything like that. They had a lot of guys like that, Roman Pfeiffer and Otis Smith.
You know what's interesting as I look back on this? They lost the game before the Saints game to go 5-5 and then never lost again.
Yep.
Ran it from there.
And it was that Rams game where they played them pretty tough, as I recall. But
24-17 final. Yeah.
Yeah. But they started one, like I said, 0-2, then 1-3. And then they went on that run where they were controlling games with their defense, with the exception of the Jets game where I think they fell behind 13-0 and came back and won 17-6. But, I mean, they're winning games like 12-9, 20-13. This is not stuff like in the second era of the Patriots, you know, after Brady injures his knee in 2008 when they become a much higher scoring team, and even before that in 07. The defense kept them, you know, in these games, and they got better as the season went along. It was one of those things where, like, oh, the momentum of winning just kind of compounds on itself. And they won that Oakland game fair and square. I don't care what anybody says.
You're right about that, but hold on. Slow down. Let me ask you about this real quick.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you were thinking during the review?
Not only do I remember what I was – I remember what I was eating. I had gotten Wendy's on my way home from a Washington Capitals loss to the Vancouver Canucks. Yes, I went to a Capitals game rather than stay home and watch the Patriots versus the Raiders. And I did not – I remember thinking, huh, it seems to be snowing an awful lot there. Nobody bothered to call and tell me about this in advance. And I was listening to the game on the radio, and this is when they were coming back in the fourth quarter. And you know, I'm sitting down, and I'm eating, and I watch, and I see the play where Woodson knocks the ball out of Brady's hands. And I thought, well, they had a good run, but yet another heartbreaking loss to Oakland in the playoffs, just like 76. And then they review it, and I'm like, well, clearly they're just reviewing it to see if his arm was going forward. And like, I don't know the rules. I mean, I don't know the tuck rule from anything.
I had never even heard of it.
Patriots fans like to say, well, it got called against us in the game against the Jets earlier in the year. And yes, that actually did happen, but I didn't know about that because, like I said, I didn't get to watch a lot of the games because the way the NFL is, I mean, if it's out of market and I live in an apartment where I can't get DirecTV, how am I going to watch this on a weekly basis?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I went to sports bars, but a lot of sports bars over the
years.
Well,
that helped when I moved to Vegas 2 years later. That was helpful for that year, but I mean, I didn't have the money to be going out too often in 2000.
I remember
DC area was a very weird place then.
I remember that I had a friend who played hockey at Elmira College, and I went to the game with his dad that night, and we were driving back, and it was a really kind of snowy, not a blizzard, but it was going to be a drive home, and the game was like in the fourth quarter. And I remember we pull into a gas station and Brady fumbles, and everyone on the radio is like, this game's over. You know, it's a fumble. And he goes in, and then he comes back out, and I'm like, yeah, somehow it's not a fumble. We couldn't see it, and they're like talking about this thing called the tuck. And my head just spinning. I'm like, I don't know, but the game's still going. And I remember he said, well, at least there's something to listen to for another 50 miles or whatever. So that's what I remember about that game, just like, and hey, that was the rule. So I mean, I'm all for enforcing the rules at end of playoff games, believe me.
My other thought too was they're down three and they still are not in field goal range. So it's like, well, how are they going to get up close enough where you can actually kick a viable field goal in this blizzard that is happening? And the attempt by Vinatieri is 45 yards, and it's said that that's the greatest kick that's ever been made. And I actually agree with that because Oakland should have blocked that kick because he had to do it on a low trajectory where if they had a guy who was 6'6 on the line, he probably just could have put his arm up and blocked it. But, I mean, you just watch that kick and how low it is because that's what he had to do to get it there. And also, you know, the footing was terrible. And Gruden, being an idiot, calls a timeout, allows the Patriots more time to clear snow. I mean, even Don Shula wasn't that much of a dumbass, and we had to run the damn snowplow out there to clear it in back in 82. But even when you go into the next week when they're playing Pittsburgh, I mean, they were a 10-point underdog in that game. But Pittsburgh played a really stupid game. Like, oh, we want to take Troy Brown out of the game, and we don't want to have his punt returns hurt us. And then they kick it to him right down the center of the field, like complete dumbasses, which par for the course for a Bill Cowher coach team, in my opinion. And then, you know, the blocked field goal leading to a touchdown on the return by the Patriots with a lateral thrown in there. That's a 10-point swing. Right there. It was 14-3. They're going to kick a field goal, make it a one possession game. And instead it's 21-3. And then they just kind of, you know, hang on for dear life because Brady hurts his ankle and Bledsoe sort of manages the game as they go into the second half.
Right, and then that builds up the controversy who should play the Super Bowl. I mean, which was more of a media-made controversy than anything, because obviously Brady was playing. I don't think Belichick thought for a second about not playing him.
Which was such a ridiculous thing because, yeah, it had to be Brady playing that game because he was, if he was healthy enough. But I remember that week there was a Rams fan, and then I was the Patriots fan in the Barnes & Noble that I worked at in Virginia at the time. And the only Patriots jersey that I had with me was a Drew Bledsoe one. So people would look at me like, oh, you're a Drew Bledsoe fan? I'm like, well, yeah, sort of, but I like Tom Brady more because he went to Michigan, and I, you know, he's the guy who got us here, and I would prefer he start. But it was like the only thing that I had to like show my support at the time. And that, I mean, that Super Bowl is one of the most memorable sports viewing experiences of my life. Just kind of, you know, on the edge of my seat for the whole thing. And they get out to the lead, and then you just kind of, at some point you're waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right, which was the Rams. That Rams team was so good. Yeah.
Yeah, and they did. I mean, there was the score that got called back because of defensive holding, which was a legitimate penalty. Tabucky Jones ran back a fumble 99 yards, and it gets called back. And then the Rams score. So that's a 14-point swing. The Rams score with a minute 28 to, or minute 30 to go. And Brady leads them down the field, which in real time, like, I don't even know where I was in my headspace, but it only in real time was about 5 minutes and 40 seconds between when the kickoff happened and Brady leading them down, kicking the field goal. And I remember I was like crouched like a catcher waiting for that ball to go through the uprights. And I had my arms up and I did the flare flop forward onto my face and then, you know, rolled over, threw my arms up in the air and probably took another swig of Labatt Blue because that was the beer that I was drinking at the time. And, you know, because I did not know what a championship was like, not since I was 7 years old in Boston. It had been since the 86 Celtics, unless you want to count the 95 Boston University Terriers, which, you know, I guess that might count. But, I mean, a professional sports championship. So it was kind of – you never forget your first, right?
Exactly. And we'll talk about mine soon. Well, look, we've went a long time. We've told a lot of great stories, which is what the Adams Division podcast is all about. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. And Peter and I are going to discuss whether or not this should be a two-parter. And I'll let you know what we decide when we come back. But we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with either our number one to five to one for each of us and a few more of your lists. Or we will come back to tell you that we've decided to make this a two-parter because no one's going to listen to a four-hour podcast. But we'll figure it out, and we'll be right back. Episode number 5 of the Adams Division podcast. Steve Bennett, Peter Winston, back with you for this awesome episode where we are counting down our top 10 favorite sports teams of all time. You just heard number 10 through 6 on both of our lists. And in a minute, we will break down the fourth wall and tell you where the rest of this is going. But first, some news from the Place to Be Nation.
On the Place to Be Nation pop feed, we got after a 2-year hiatus, Dadcast is back with JT and Don talking about a variety of annoyances in parenting, such as potty training, lying, Nickelodeon shows, and more. I don't know much about that, but do give that a listen. Russell and Sam deliver their season 1 finale of 90 to Nothing with a look at Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. On Year in Pop, Andy and Scott are joined by John D'Amato and Dr. G to discuss news, music, and movies of the year 1975. Pop goes to the movies with Andy Atherton's review of the new live-action Aladdin, along with the hard-traveling fanboys continuing Avengers Month with an installment of Longbook Hunters looking at New Avengers Volume 1 Breakout. And the NBA Team podcast dropped a double shot of episodes, including Gone Fishing Part 1 and an NBA Finals preview pod blast looking at the series between the Raptors and the Warriors. And that is also covered on This Week in Sports with the Cowboy and D'Amato running down the NBA Finals and breaking down the series between the Warriors and the Raptors. Keep an eye on social media feeds as the reboot of the greatest song of the 80s tournament is starting again soon. And I'm sure, I sure hope that more Gap Band songs get nominated for this one. How's everything on the PTBN wrestling feeds, Steve?
Well, first, a quick question. Do you have any idea how a metal fan from Providence is nicknamed the Cowboy?
You know, I'd love to come up with like a quip there, but I'm a little slow at this hour.
Well, see, he was a huge fan of Sam Houston, so he went by the Cowboy. All right,
that
on the place
so great.
On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. You go over there, and the Place to Be Nation podcast, Justin Scott and Jake Williams dive into the May 89 Meadowlands House Show. That's episode 529. And then, for the first time in a long time, the main show did back-to-back nights with a double dose of Saturday night's main event, May and July 89, with guest some jabroni named Winston. In the sixth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zanny welcomes Daniel Maccabi, why did I get the tough names?
Daniel Maccabi.
Maccabi to talk music and his independent wrestling career. I don't know him, but I'm sure he's a fantastic wrestler.
He was on an episode of Between the Sheets. He's very good.
Yeah, see Maccabi.
He's a good listen.
Now that you say that, it looks like Maccabi. I apologize, Dan. Yeah. All right, Scott, Nate, and Steve recap Double or Nothing and Classic TNA on the newest edition of Main Event. On placetobe.com, check out Steve Riddle's countdown of the top 25 matches in TakeOver history as we prepare for another TakeOver this weekend. Also available on the site is the latest installment of PTBN's excellent WWE Network Adventure with an in-depth look at Mid-South 526-84. Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV Greatest Match Ever project. Get in the conversation and start researching your list today. Okay, I think that's it for the Place to Be Nation plug. It's a mouthful, but God bless everyone who does great work over there. We're proud to be a part of it. Peter and I just had a discussion off air. It is currently 12:45 a.m. We've been at this since about 10:30. It's a very long podcast, which our episodes usually are because we're both very verbose and we tell these stories and kind of, I think that's what people appreciate about it. And we've decided that we can go on no further. And we will make this a two-part episode. And within a week or so, we will get part two up. But that's it for tonight, right, Peter?
Yeah, you don't want to hear me completely drunk at the end of some podcast talking about the Larry Bird Celtics. You want to hear me completely sober talking about the Larry Bird Celtics. Although if you do want to hear me pretty ripped on an Adam's Vision podcast, go back to the WrestleMania countdown one and listen to the last 30 minutes. Cause I say that as to provide a little bit of an Easter egg for those of you to go back and actually listen to what I'm saying. I told you that, Steve, right?
Oh yeah. You told me that story.
Like I had like four bourbons as we were recording that. I was like, oh, I can't.
And then there was that no more. Which one were we recording when I was just like, look, man, I can't even sit in this chair anymore. So I wasn't feeling well.
That was the Survivor Series one.
Yeah, which, so we always go into these with this like ambitious plans. And then something seems to always remind us that, you know, we talk too much. So we're never going to get through all this in a reasonable amount of time. With that said, I think that's it for tonight. Peter Winston is my buddy. I'm Steve Bennett. This is the Adams Division Podcast, and we will be back in about a week with part two. Find out who the top five teams on each of our lists, and that'll also give you a chance to submit a list if you'd like. You can find me on Twitter I'm at @sports_casters. You can find Peter on Twitter at @GFAllentownPod. Listen to our other podcasts in the meantime. We finish this, and we are out.